You always do the intro.
Do I?
I never do. I'm not the intro.
You can do the intro.
I just sit on the side and lip off.
No. Do you want to do the intro this time?
No. Comfortable sitting on the side and lipping off.
Okay.
You know the podcast voice.
All right.
I've got a question for you, Nick.
You're going.
What do you reckon is the best case that you can go to as a paramedic? What's got some of the most reward?
The most rewarding cases?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I've got a couple.
Do you want a specific case?
No, 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 just like the, you know, generic.
Oh, generically.
Yeah.
I like the jobs I can go to that I can get an outcome without having to open my kit. I can get an outcome by just sitting down with someone and talking to them.
That's we could do a whole podcast on that. Mine are literally if I can catch a baby successfully.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, give it up to the mum. Or if I successfully resuscitate someone. Now, I love hearing about these. Love talking about these. Love sharing these. But something I don't think we talk about much is what happens when we go to the resuscitation and we don't get the outcome we want. You had many of those?
It's more common than people think, and I don't think we train necessarily very well for the reality of the world, which is a lot of the time these resuscitations are not successful.
No, and this is also why we got Dr. Sandy McQuarrie with us today. G'day, Sandy.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Well.
That's good
really
to
well.
Know.
Happy to be invited.
Excellent. So,
that's thank you to the two of you.
Now, we're not going to be talking about these merry, fairy, happy cases today.
No, not at all. We're going to be talking about cases that are a part of life.
So, in other words, death and dying?
Absolutely.
In paramedic care.
Yeah. And maybe if we had time, a paramedic who has died a few times.
Well, we might have to talk to that paramedic too. But, hey, really quickly for the listener, Sandy, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, how long you've been working as a paramedic, where you've worked, et cetera, et cetera?
So, from the accent, you can tell I'm from Canada. I have been a paramedic. Took my initial training in 1992, 3 months long. Pretty good.
Quite extensive there.
Pretty good. Next day you're running calls.
1992.
Wow. Started, the landscape in Canada was a lot of private ambulance services, mom and pop shops, and spent a few years doing that. Got into teaching, did some advanced care training, did some flight work, moved to central Canada and picked up speed. Was critical care flight paramedic.
I was wondering where that was going then.
For a bit.
So what did you do before you were a paramedic?
I was an agronomist.
A what?
Yeah, you asked. So I went to Bovine University. Moo you. So I'm like a fifth generation farming family from Prince Edward Island. So you think of it, kind of the expectation is, oh, it's you, you know, get some training. Here's the family farm. That was kind of it. So struck off, did a Bachelor of Science, actually, in agronomy, and graduated in 86, came home, was doing, it's called extension work, where you teach farmers how to do best practice. Funny that. Got married, had a farm, do all the sorts of things that you're supposed to do, and got turned on to what became my love of paramedicine through joining a rural fire department in Prince Edward Island, who had great rescue capability, very remote, and had 4 paramedics, although they weren't called paramedics at that time. And we'd get a lot of road trauma for long periods of time. So I traveled with them and watched them, and I said, this is what's missing in my life. So I went to, at that time, EMT-1 school, started doing the private ambulance services, got involved in education, Central Canada, chief flight paramedic for the province of Ontario, then deputy chief for the Ottawa Paramedic Service, all of which to say is I'm not very smart, but I interview well.
From agronomist to paramedic, I mean, it sounds like your experiences.
Yeah, I went back to the East Coast at about 2007. Between bobbing and weaving, I ran a paramedic training school and then arm of educational services for Medivh EMS for 5 years and set sail for Oz, as I said in my recent writings, tertiary education called in 2013 and I answered. Off to Oz to teach as a lecturer in the paramedic program at Charles Sturt University. They dangled what they called a PhD, which I didn't even know what it stood for, in front of me, and I said, oh, I think I can do that too. That's another story. And fast forward to 4.5 years ago, I was lucky enough to come to Griffith University here and meet you folks.
So is that, if my calculations are correct, plus 30 years of experience there in some form of paramedic care, paramedicine, paramedic practice?
Yeah, all across the spectrum of frontline care, probably at least half my career, to middle and senior management, to education, to, and I'm back, as you know, kind of returned to clinical practice now these last several years. In new and interesting and unique clinical settings.
So operationally, you would have seen a lot. I mean, that's what most paramedics are told. You know, gee, you must see a lot in the job you do. I would imagine there would have been unfortunately, a fair bit of death and dying.
Yes.
A lot of exposure to it. So I have a very simple question for you. With 30 years' experience and when we were moving from operational to management and education, when you look at or reflect on some of these, how well prepared were you?
Oh, I wasn't. And it's not a reflection of the quality of the education I got either as an EMT-1 or EMT intermediate or EMT paramedic. That was not an issue. They successfully embedded in me resuscitation skills and you know, medical emergencies and all those sorts of things that usually lead towards a safe, you know, happy outcome for everyone. I had to learn and watch my preceptors and mentors and partners as they navigated around the area of the expected death, the unanticipated, and the resuscitation that has not been successful.
Do you remember your first death?
Yes. And please don't take that laughter as being derisive. It's not. I worked for a private ambulance service, and the private ambulance service not only gave care to the living, but also did body removal.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so I got quite good at it. Right, there would be a death in the community, so not a, as we would call it, a 911 or a 000 call. Not, we knew going in there was recognition of life extinct guidelines in place, and we would do the body removal and take them to the hospital or take them to the morgue or take them to the funeral home.
Is that a common thing in Canada, or just being a rural and remote area?
Not anymore, because it's an inappropriate use of an ambulance.
Yep,
isn't it? Because if we took it, the ambulance was then offline.
I was just thinking, I don't think in any of the services I've worked in, we've been responsible for that, but that would make sense, and if things have now changed.
I've heard of it in Australia in some really remote places, but I don't think it's common practice.
Oh, no, it would be an outlier now, but at that time, kind of in eastern Canada and some parts of Canada, ambulance services, especially the private ones that first had an ambulance parked out front, were funeral home-based. And that's because they had the ability to do horizontal transport. Yeah. So they had a hearse, and they also put an ambulance beside it. And you could, you know, many of my paramedic friends in Canada that are still practicing would have started at a funeral home doing the funeral home duties. And when a call came in, would get in the ambulance, and off they go. So, yeah, in terms of practice changing, it's been immeasurable. But in terms of the ability to come in and psychologically prepare yourself, others, family, the circle, for any of those that I just mentioned, the expected death, the unexpected death, the resuscitation that has not, you've either failed to start, not failed to start, but did not undertake or did not turn out with a, you know, return of spontaneous circulation. No, I think that's why we need to talk about it today.
So you're both academics in Australia. So you're teaching, you know, the next cohort of paramedics. For those listeners overseas in Australia, almost all of our paramedics now start their education at a university level, obtain a qualification or a degree, and then enter a workforce either in the public or private sector. So you're both academics in that teaching space at the moment. What do you think are the attitudes towards death and dying from your students, and how do you approach it within your education?
It's an interesting question, Nick, because I don't think there's any way to give you a black and white or definitive answer here, because it is such a varied experience for both paramedics, academics, and even students coming into this. Everyone has different expectations and everyone has different experiences. I certainly draw on my own experiences professionally to bring things in a classroom. I mean, it's interesting when I even listen to Sandy speak, you know, the question was about, you know, your first cardiac arrest or your first dead person. And I mean, there's even instances where paramedics are being caught out and certainly almost shamed on media because of the terminology they're using. Things like incompatible with life or recognition of life extinct or even dead person. And there doesn't seem to be any one universally defined or accepted way to even discuss this, which is probably why it's not discussed enough. I was thinking when Sandy was talking, you know, the first dead person I saw was actually when I was in the army and it was in a war zone. But interestingly, when I think about the first person that I saw when I was a student paramedic, who was deceased, it affected me completely differently. And I honestly can't tell you whether that was because, you know, maybe in a war zone these things were expected, as opposed to working out in the ambulance, or wherever you're in a service or in the private sector. Maybe it's not. But certainly my preparation leading into it was a certainly a discussion around the successful cases and the good feel stories. There wasn't a whole lot of preparation for me as a student paramedic back in my day. I'm now running courses with first-year students who are going to be going into their first placement soon, and one of the skill sets we're teaching them is cardiac arrest management. And even when I review the scenarios they're going to be doing, they were certainly stacked heavily on managing a patient who has spontaneous circulation or has good outcomes. So we've been redefining it. That's why it's such an exciting podcast to even be doing with Sandy, because I think this is one of those things that we need to talk about more, we need to accept more, because if I'm just going to have a quick look here, Nick. I'm going to give you some stats. Let's have a Each year, approximately 77% of paramedics in Australia deliver at least one death notification.
Wow.
77% of our paramedics out there on the street are delivering at least one death notification a year. And I don't have the stats for the scenarios that I was pushing out last year, but it certainly wasn't 70% of those resulting in death notifications. So it's a learning journey even for me. But Sandy, you've been in the paramedic game a lot longer than I. You've been in the teaching game even longer. Where do you see our shortcomings or our delivery of this?
Yeah, so let's say I can't comment on anyone else's teaching of paramedic across Australia, teaching of paramedics in the undergraduate space, because that would be unfair. It's not going to be one broad brush. I would suggest that there's a broad number of cases that result as presented to first, second, and third year students where there is a successful outcome or certainly not a more marked deterioration. And that would be true, would have been true in my own teaching as well. So when I have the ability to, I put a cardiac arrest simulation together with a young child, and the students come in and it's intractable. And truth be known, it's going to be given next Monday. And it's the same one I give it every year. And you watch them go through their skills and they're quite good. And then working within this 20-minute time frame, which most university scenarios tend to run, and they're becoming more and more frustrated because there's no sudden return of spontaneous circulation. And we get to the end, and there's still no improvement. We stop, and we do our debrief, and the debrief takes as long as the call did to run, and it's always the same, and that is, I fully expected to have a successful resuscitation, Sandy. I'm not quite sure what to think right now. I think it's my fault.
That's a really interesting point.
Wow. And this is in a classroom. This is in an educational
setting. Third year students, my course. And it's designed not to be mean, but to present a physiologic case that does not change.
It's a realistic case, though.
And it's a child. Yeah, it is. It's a real case.
It's also a realistic human response that what have I done wrong?
It's them 100% of the time. That's generalization. They'll search within themselves and their partner and the people that were around them to say, well, was my bad CPR? Was it the fact that I waited too long to do a sit rep? Was it, you know, the order that I gave the drugs? What was it? And I'll say, it was intractable.
It's interesting. Imagine that I was just doing a quick review of some cardiac arrest data in Australia, and I'm going to use Queensland as an example. And they attended about 5,200 cardiac arrests in 2020. What percentage of those do you think we resuscitated?
Actively resuscitated?
Yeah.
I would have no idea. How many did you say they went to?
5,200.
Okay, so it's in one
across
state.
Across Queensland, in one state. This is a public ambulance service. Oh. What percentage of those do you think we resuscitate if we're going off the way in which we train?
Oh, I would be throwing random numbers at you, Nick. I have no idea.
I would say, sorry, they started a resuscitation or they said, not going to do that?
Started a resuscitation.
Yeah.
So
maybe half?
Yeah, okay. So it was actually 40%.
So over half of the cardiac arrests attended to by paramedics in this state were not even initiated.
Or is it vice versa? Was it a 40% attempt rate or a 60% attempt rate?
So it was a 40% attempt
rate. Attempt rate. 60% no attempt.
So this is just
and that shouldn't say no attempt. There was they simply didn't start or
So 60% of those cases were death notifications or recognition of life extinct, whatever terminology paramedics want to use.
Correct. Do you think where 60% of our cardiac arrest simulations are you walking inside and going, this patient's deceased, I'm very sorry, ma'am, your husband's dead?
I have not seen one.
You've worked at a number of universities. How often are we doing those scenarios?
Be single digit, if anything.
This is a comms skill. It's not a clinical skill. This is a comms skill.
It's communications. Overlapping on professional practice, overlapping on ethics, overlapping on just being a good human.
So it comes back to like all of our paramedic experiences start with how we train. Does the training match what happens out in the real world?
So I can see Sandy shaking his head here. It's interesting because
We look at that and we go, okay, 40% of only 40% of these cardiac arrest patients are even getting CPR. Yeah, so should only 40% of our cardiac arrest scenarios be resuscitated?
To bring the realism into it, potentially, yes. I mean, to also prepare the paramedics, yes, because when most of the scenarios that are delivered, most of the training, most of the CPD involve actually commencing the arrest, it negates, neglects, or completely omits the other skill set, which is communicating with people when there's nothing to be done. Because normally, and it's not every case, we can't generalize, but there are other people on scene.
Well, there's still patients on scene. Mm. They're just not the patient who's deceased. It's their family member who's now in a state of shock or grief.
Yep. Especially in the unexpected death or sudden death. But no, we, I'll say, in my practice, have seen a lot of 20-minute scenarios. They start off okay, they deteriorate, there's some sort of intervention and a good outcome followed by a good debrief. But what's not being taught about is that hard skill of understanding you are not going to resuscitate. There are people expecting you to resuscitate, or you've started one, you've got to the point where you've met the clinical parameters, and you have to turn to someone and say those words. And what are those words and how do you say them, Steve?
Which is the terminology that often gets paramedics, I'm going to use the word roasted by media, because there is certain language that some define as acceptable, some don't. But I don't believe there is a one-stop shop here either. Every situation is going to be different. Some people are offended at death, dying, dead, deceased. That's a tough one, Sandy.
It's a very tough one.
And
but we can't hide from it.
It's a tough one while I'm sitting here talking to you. So if I was out at a death notification, I would be just as stumped. And this is with decades of experience, which is ironic because, I mean, we knew we were coming here to talk about something that was less fun, but there's also a lot of learning here for anyone. Doesn't matter if you've got 6 months experience or 10, 20 years experience. This is something that most paramedics have probably fumbled and stumbled their way through and survived to only then fumble and stumble through the next one as well. There's something interesting here, Sandy. Listen to this. 77% of paramedics deliver at least one death notification a year. Now, paramedics who deliver 1 to 5 death notifications in the previous 12 months of this study that I'm reading here had a 36% a greater chance of experiencing burnout than those who didn't deliver the death notifications. Now, is that because they're unprepared? Could that be because they are marginally unprepared?
Or are they doing that many cardiac arrests that they're doing way too much overtime?
Is that they're unprepared to deliver a death notification, or is that exposure to a large amount of high acuity work
based on
the role that they're working in?
That's it. Yeah, that's my question.
Like, you think in the cohort of persons that are more likely to do that amount of death notifications are your critical care cohort. So not only are they doing a lot of cardiac arrest, they're also doing a lot of sick asthmas, trauma, medical cases. So they're doing a large...
A lot of confounding factors.
Yeah, I don't think it's... It'll probably never come down to one variable.
And there's a lot of different ways, too, you can experience this. You know, I mean, there can be the traumatic cardiac arrests. And depending on the injury sustained by that person, that can be, you know, a lot more confronting than others. There can also be the death notification or the cardiac arrest that you go to, and either there is a legal document that prevents you from starting, even though people on scene wish you to, or it can be the other way around.
It's interesting you mentioned that around the that legal paperwork. So in Australia, we use like a do not resuscitate order. And looking back at that data again, the cardiac arrest data for 2020 in the state of Queensland in Australia, of those 5,700 cardiac arrests that were attended, only 80 were not attempted due to DNR paperwork.
And that
so
would,
it's a very small amount.
It would mean the paperwork was available, though.
That's right.
See, this is, I'm thinking of one of the more complex cardiac arrests that I ever experienced myself. And this is, you know, 10 years ago now. But it was because a patient had been discharged from the hospital, a palliative patient, to go home and die in a peaceful place. And when the patient did expire, they did the right thing where they called the emergency service. What else do they do? But the first crew who got there, I don't want to say they were young and inexperienced, but they certainly were unprepared for what presented to them when they got there. But it was a patient in cardiac arrest who was far too young to be in cardiac arrest. And a family essentially preventing them or attempting to prevent them from starting their assessments because a do not resuscitate order existed, but it had been left at the hospital. So they couldn't cite it. And it created a very, very complex and a very emotionally explosive situation where the paramedics were concerned about their legal responsibilities to commence, and the family were very emotionally invested in preventing that from happening. And I don't think anything even remotely prepared me for arriving on scene to find that as well, because there were two camps, both as scared as the next, without any clear direction. And that one wouldn't appear in those statistics of 80 do not resuscitate orders because that paperwork didn't exist on scene.
Well, a lot of the time, and it's hard to determine how many, but a lot of the time these resuscitations are ceased more around the idea of good medical practice and making sure that we deliver good medical practice. So these palliative patients, or they're in a nursing home and they have a sudden deterioration and they're in cardiac arrest, but it wouldn't be within good medical practice to continue resuscitation. And I think paramedics sometimes struggle to make good decisions and sound decisions in the realms of good medical practice quickly in an emotive scene. Still trying to maintain that legal responsibility. So it can be quite a difficult decision to do for a junior clinician.
But is this due to a lack of rehearsal?
I think so. And I also think it's also partly to do with their concern they're going to get in trouble if they don't resuscitate them.
I have an interesting call. It's a variation on yours. Stephen, that is sudden cardiac death, middle of the night, called in, family's in the room, patient, the person is in bed and is dead. And moved to the floor, started CPR. I was one of my first kind of, as an ALS provider. It was 1999. sorry, 1997. You probably weren't even born then. So I led the resuscitation, tubed him, IV, shocks, drugs, got him back. Spontaneous circulation, good pressures, moved him to hospital. And they said, oh, yes, we know this gentleman. He's end-stage CA, which is cancer. And he survived another 3 days because I successfully resuscitated him. There was a DNR. No family member wanted to or thought of or considered presenting it to us when we were trying to figure this part out. And we didn't know the medical history until we got him to hospital. The chronic stuff. So you're right. So there's this idea of we've attempted this good medical practice. We had what I thought was a good outcome. We were high-fiving each other and this is really good. And then you go, oh, so this is where we're at. So we've done this thing that's all kind of, we need to say the word death, dying, and dead. And so that everybody can hear it. We're not talking about going away, passing, slipped off, you know, this mortal coil. We're talking about people who are dead.
And this is something that paramedics
need to talk about it. Physiologically, and, you know, in our arc, which we're all somewhere in it, it's expected, it's anticipated, it cannot be outrun. You know, there's no cryogenic freezing here. We are all going to die. We all need to say the D word. And
which one? You gave me three.
Yeah.
Death,
well, they're all
dying, dead.
You know, either a noun, adjective, or verb. And physiologically, the act of dying is normal. it is a shutting down, no matter what the, you know, the underlying cause is. What kills us all in the end is shock, you know, end organ dysfunction and no perfusion. That is the terminal, no matter what the etiology is of getting you to that point. But it's expected. It's your body over time will get to the point where it'll start to senesce, as mine is, because I'm not as strong as I used to be. As you go past that arc towards, you know, what might be considered a normal lifespan, some are short, some are longer. But we need to understand it's anticipated in the people that we're going to meet in our role as a professional paramedic, and understanding that and having really good protocols, algorithms, clinical practice guidelines from our service or private provider gives us the rehearsal time to be able to deliver the death notification.
Why have we forgotten that people die?
I don't think we like to talk about it.
Is it a Western society thing?
Well, this is exactly what I was about to say. See, Sandy and I have had the privilege of actually working together in some low GDP countries, and we've had some, well, let's call them clinical adventures. And when I look at these lower GDP countries, they have a lot less infrastructure. Health, is delivered vastly differently. But people in these areas seem to be far more attuned and acceptable, or accepting, I should say, of death because they see it. When someone gets hit by a car here, it's in a lot of developed places, you will have every emergency service under the sun descend on that scene. They will shelter the vast population from it. Mm. They will then scoop and run anyone they can. They will then hide what they need, and then they will clean that road. And there'll be traffic flowing down it in sometimes less than an hour like nothing happened, and someone has literally just died on that street. A lot of family members get put into care homes these days rather than staying with the families. And so someone else is looking after them when they do ultimately expire. That's not a D word, is it, Sandy? See what I did there?
Means you have a best before date.
Due date or best before date?
Best before.
Still good.
There seems to be a lot of emphasis on protecting people from this reality death and dying. And then that translates to our education of paramedics who are then incredibly confronted by a dead patient.
Yeah. And here's one to throw out too, is how many times have you offered or allowed or encouraged family members to be present during your resuscitation?
I do it all the time.
I've learned, again, there's no one rule suits, but majority of my experiences have certainly taught me that most people would prefer to be involved.
Yeah. Mm. Certainly offered the option. Mm. I always say, they're very, very sick right now. We're going to do some things and some interventions. You're welcome to stay, or you can perhaps go somewhere where you don't have direct line of sight, but we're going to continue to work. They're very, very sick.
You know, interestingly, Nick, the Expedition Medicine course that's departing later this year, one of their add-ons as their acclimatization phase that those people are going to be going through is that they can actually go to the public crematorium in Kathmandu and actually witness a incredibly moving cultural event where the people bring their family members down to the riverbank and actually cremate them in public. Mm. So it's an optional add-on for people, and it is a very moving experience for a lot of the clinicians who attend this course in Nepal, because it is certainly something that we are protected from here and we just never see. Mm. Which then I think translates to these issues that we're discussing, possibly this burnout.
When you did your research, you did your PhD around paramedic wellness.
Yes.
In that PhD,
you did too.
I know. That's a whole nother podcast.
We've got the right person.
I know. In that research and the subsequent research you've done since then, have you seen any themes or specific commentary around cardiac arrest and that relating or exposure to death and relating to paramedic well-being? Or
yeah. So I've always been interested in paramedic wellness, health, and well-being. So as part of my PhD, I was fortunate to work with 32 paramedics from New South Wales Ambulance over a period of about 6 months. This is 2015, 2016. And we followed them through their day with biometric monitoring, a shirt they wore that gave pretty complex, clean signals of what their physiology was doing. They would acquire their own blood pressure, report their own fatigue. Of that subset, so 30 paramedics, 6 months, that yielded 1,000 calls. Mm. of which we got all the data from the ambulance service in terms of timestamps and chief complaint and all that sort of stuff. So we could do a deep dive into their physiology. So we found of that 1,000 calls, 32 paramedics, they attended and worked 17 cardiac arrests where they were there from start to finish with several successful resuscitations. So you see kind of the trip to the hospital and what's happening to the paramedic. And from a physiologic point of view, that high stakes, high intensity with CPR was putting a massive physiologic demand on them.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, they would report on those days being really fatigued. In fact, we had a paramedic who did, I think, either two or three rests in a row. And what we saw, because there's accelerometers on the paramedics, is we'd see a change in the way they were doing CPR. A change.
So you're monitoring the physiological status of them.
Yeah.
Were any of these paramedics interviewed?
Well, no. So it wasn't a mixed method. So they would report a number, a fatigue number at the end of each shift, beginning and end of each shift. It would always go up. But in terms of their response to that particular subset of calls, no.
But you're seeing a physiological change in them.
Yep.
It'll be hard not to then assume there would be a mental change to them.
They're all one, Steve. They're all one. You are one engine.
For our listeners, what's the implications of physiological stress on a paramedic?
Physiologic stress is stress. Acute stress in a young, otherwise healthy person is how we were designed from an evolutionary perspective. Mm. We were supposed to run when the saber-toothed tiger chased us. Mm. That's kind of physical and physiologic stress, and we also have psychological stress. But ultimately, as long as you have this good underlying health, reasonable health status, reasonable BMI, reasonable lipid level, all that sort of stuff, you will withstand it. You'll come back to your baseline. But what we found with the more unhealthy from a health status point of view, the paramedic was that we were monitoring, the more unhealthy, the longer it took them, if ever, to come back to their physiologic baseline after a call.
Yeah.
Even the rest of the shift. That was eye-opening for me. Long-term stress is not good. So we all know the stress response and the HPA axis and sympathomedullary response, yada yada, but we kick out cortisol, kick out epi, cortisol, continuous cortisol with that. It's an inflammatory response, hormone, is a good thing, but not all the time. And it's circulating and circulating and circulating, and it's associated with metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, any number of illnesses that will come and stay.
Mm.
Chronic stress.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
So I just want to circle back to, our own lived experiences with cardiac arrest. Sandy, you have a very unique experience, a personal experience relating to cardiac arrest because I'll let you fill us in about what your experience has been.
You're speaking about his 30 years of experience trying to resuscitate people, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So for the folks that are listening, last year I had 4 periods of cardiac arrest.
Personally,
so 2022. I'll paint the picture. Relatively healthy person. My biggest complaint is I've had a lot of birthdays, so therefore I'm older. Or maybe that's a good thing. I've had a lot of birthdays, and not to make, I make light of it as a bit of a mechanism of defense for myself, because I'm talking about me dying 4 times, and I did at least 4, probably more. I had been well and training for a triathlon, and training actually very, very, very hard, and probably not looking after myself in that respect. And kind of the first week in November, I was on a Zoom call, so that you could title this one "Death on a Zoom Call." And I was talking with another paramedic in New Zealand. We were having a chat, and all of a sudden he said, "You just passed out in front of me." And I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Yes, you did." And I said, "No, I didn't." We argued back and forth for a little while, but I just remember feeling so disoriented and not knowing what had just happened. I had no idea. I had no recollection of passing out. He said, "I want you to I'm going to stay on the line. You're going to call 000. I'm going to stay on the line with you. Call your neighbor." I did all those things. They picked me up. The ambulance, the paramedics came.
He thought he was going to do a death notification over Zoom.
Yeah. No, different.
Sorry.
Great paramedics, phenomenal paramedics, local Gold Coast paramedics. And they worked me up physiologically fine and transported me, but didn't get to the hospital, not right away.
Mm.
No, trip down from where I live to a little town called Narang. I'm talking with them, feeling kind of distant, like I'm looking down a tunnel and feeling really drug out and really sleepy. And then I woke up, and that was a while later. I had defib pads on. He was cannulating me. I had gone into a systole. I had died a second time within, you know, an hour and a half. And there was more paramedics in the back of the truck because they had stopped and called extra help. And it was, they did everything perfectly, managed me very well. Physiologically, quite sound. You know, I had this period of, you know, 25 seconds of asystole. It was a Bradier systolic arrest, slow down, slow down, slow down, stop. And then started again. And off we went, tossed to the hospital, did a lot of investigation. I have a condition called SVT, so I was on a couple of meds for that. And we thought the culprit was one of the meds.
Well, it certainly slowed you down.
It did at that point. So we adjusted everything, and I promised to be a good boy, and they sent me home. And I was pretty good. And 5 weeks later, at the same desk.
Were you on a Zoom call again?
No.
But I don't. Skype call?
I arrested again. No, I was just doing some work. Yeah. I arrested again. I knew it because I woke up feeling the same way I had 5 weeks before.
I just wouldn't sit at that desk anymore.
Yeah.
I missed the desk.
But the constellation of signs and symptoms in the run-up were feeling exceptionally draggy. And you think of someone who trains hard every single day without a break, headache, feeling unwell. And as I entered this Bradier systolic, the Brady part, I would become, it was just like you would be down a tunnel if I was looking at you, Nick. You'd be way far away from me, and I wouldn't feel like we're even in the same room. And then unconscious, which is to say dead. Happened again, call the neighbor, repeat, another crew, down to Gold Coast Private, actually, and where you get wonderful care. My wife was there. They paged my electrophysiologist. Everybody was happy because I was physiologically well. I was sitting on the side of the bed. And I remember thinking, there's that feeling again. And I turned to look at the monitor. And when I first turned, it was at 60. And then 1 second, 2 seconds later, it was at 40. And I don't remember anything after that. So it went to zero immediately.
Was your electrophysiologist in the room at the time?
He was not far away. He was in a procedure, but he came in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as it was, I was perched on the side of the bed and I fell out. And my wife, bless her, Caroline, caught me before I hit the floor. Can you imagine having to catch your husband who's just arrested in front of you, literally struggles and manhandles me back onto the bed, and I wake up, regain consciousness with the code team around me, ready to start CPR. So in short order, after all of those very similar signs and symptoms, I had been as a kind of a, I don't know, middle-aged male guy thinking, I don't want what is obviously coming, which is a pacemaker. I don't want that. I'm a, you know, vital guy. I'm happy. I play ice hockey. Come on. No. So by the time the electrophysiologist came, Dr. Matthew Rowe, and he said, yeah, you know where you're at, aren't you? Don't you, Sandy? And I said, yeah, let's get that pacemaker in. They put me on isopril to keep my heart going for that time, 24 hours, because I was non-fasting. And it felt like I had a main line of caffeine. But they kept my heart rate above, they would titrate it to about 70 to 80. Next morning, they popped in a demand pacemaker, AV sequential, and I've had probably the last 6 months of most the best health I've had probably in quite some time.
Wow.
So death and dying, and psychologically, it's changed my life. I have a new perspective. First perspective is make sure that your wife has all your passwords and knows where all your retirement savings are. That's number one. Went home, wrote it all down, gave it to her.
Making notes.
That's number two is, holy shit, this is life. And it ended for me in succession over a number of times. What's important to me now? What's less important? And what makes no difference whatsoever? Mm. In terms of professional, personal, and the nexus where they meet. Like, and it's changed me. So I have a lot less of a give a shit factor. I discharge my duties well, exceptionally well, as a paramedic and an academic, but I'm trying to be a better human. Yeah,
wow.
I've been a little kinder. I say now if I had a choice, I'd rather be kind than right. I try to be way more empathetic, way, way, way. There's another pair of shoes over there. See if you fit in them, because that's their perspective. And there's times that you can't get to that point, but I practice gratitude every day, which is new for me. And I write down a journal of my gratitudes each night and try and do what I would describe as being present, but it's mindfulness. And so that's a direct result, direct, of those events and everything that flowed out of them.
That's a phenomenal story. I've got someone talking to me right now who has died several times. A word you just used then, as you said, it's made you more empathetic. Now, I find this interesting. I want to latch on to this for a second because through this entire chat, and it's been incredible to sit through this, we've talked about the lack of preparation and training for death notification or you know, dying patients from a paramedic perspective. And we've also talked about, you know, potentially the physiological effects it has on those paramedics through, you know, the lack of preparation, lack of rehearsals, etc. But when you just mentioned it's made you more empathetic, it made me think about the other people involved in a, let's call it a poorly delivered death notification, let's call it a poorly managed dead patient, the people who are often there, the family members. You said your wife caught you. Now, I'm sure that the way the clinicians around her spoke to her immediately following that would have significant impact on her, short-term and long-term. What are the implications of a poorly managed death notification from a paramedic for the people who are also present, for the people who are there?
Yeah, there's a there's those that continue living after the person, not the patient, the person dies.
Now, thankfully, you're one of the people who have continued living. This is good, we can talk about
this. For now. I can remember going on calls. And by the way, my first death that I witnessed wasn't body removal. It was just lots of that. My first weekend as a student on-the-job training or placement, car crash, T-bone collision, rural Canada, minus 20, where I had been T-boned by another car. There was two patients trapped in the car that I went to. First one was dead, looked dead. Was, you know, this was probably a 25-minute response time to scene, at least, maybe 30. So he'd been pulseless, breathless that whole time. He had been forced, he was forced up against the other passenger and pinned, or the driver at that time, pinned her against the driver's door, and his head broke all of her ribs on that side. I remember that quite clearly. It was like a circle on x-ray. And watching my preceptor understand and relay to the driver, who was conscious and quite hysterical, that we weren't going to resuscitate him because he was dead, and we're going to do everything we can to work with you and carry on. She was a marvelous paramedic, marvelous person. So that was my first. But so going into a 70-year-old not breathing, you go to check it out, and he has passed away, has died during the night peacefully, is in bed, been married for 55 years, and his now widow, or the wife, is in the kitchen, and we deliver the news that this, there was rigor, there was all the, you know, pooling. We're sorry. He's passed away. He's gone. And that was the language we thought she would understand best. And we stopped right there to say, because now, as well as the legal implications and the people that need to be called, it's her. Mm-hmm. She is now with us in our circle of care. So you say, can we put some tea on for you? Can we have a chat, sit and chat with you just for a minute? Who should we call for you? And that's a rural, it was that time, rural Nova Scotia kind of thing. And you start to make her, not validate, but certainly allow the grieving process to begin.
Now, you used the word gone.
Three words, actually, but that was one of them.
I'm gonna actually emphasize what you said earlier about dead, dying, death. Let's run with those. Because I can recall a case where we were running a resuscitation. And we were in, is it 10% nationwide, ROSC?
Probably.
It's about 30% of what you resuscitate. So what's that, 30% of your 40?
Yeah, okay.
So that's 12.
All right, that's low.
10, 12.
Of all we were in the 10%. We got ROSC. Let's high five each other. We got ROSC. But we had realized we got ROSC just as we dueled up another shock. Now, you guys and anyone else listening who's worked in the field would understand how insanely loud and frustrating that alarm is. So it's ringing saying, hey, we're fully charged, we're ready to go. Boop, 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 you know, it is just there. And we've realized we've got ROSC. And I mean, this is what you've been working for, and this is what we need to maintain. We need to sustain that heartbeat. We need to do everything we can to make sure we don't lose that heartbeat. And so silencing the alarm was a lower priority at this point. But the alarm was there and it was getting increasingly more frustrating. And just as the patient's wife, because none of the family actually wanted to be in the room, walked back in the room to see what was going on, one of the guys I worked with had said, "Can you silence that effing alarm?" And one of the guys had said, "Yep," pressed the button and said, "Okay, mate, it's gone." And all she heard was,
"It's gone.
It's gone." And so turned and we heard her wailing up the hallway, running into the family, screaming, "He's gone, he's gone." Now, I get goosebumps because this is funny reflecting on this a couple of years later. If you've got some dark humor aspects, this is reasonably funny. But it's not, because this had significant impact on that woman and her family by the language we used. It's gone. Mm. I can guarantee the alarm was gone. He wasn't gone. Now, if he had pitched off, if he had died in a couple of days' time, it would have made this even worse. Now, thankfully, he was one of the few that actually walked out of hospital, but it was the language. And I just read an article here that was actually written by a Victorian paramedic called Charlie Gadd. You know Charlie Gadd.
I do.
Yeah, and it says, "The death notification must be simple. It must be done using the words dead or died, making sure to avoid euphemisms, which may allow for confusion or denial." Isn't that interesting?
I think there's some demographic influence there too.
Yeah.
I think you need to know this was a 70-year-old person mm-hmm. who her entire life would have used that language. Mm-hmm. Our neighbor has passed. Our mm-hmm. neighbor is gone. Mm-hmm. Would have used and understood it. And it's not a deferential thing, but I thought as you start to put together your sentences, what is going to get her to understand in not a kind way as possible, but least confronting way possible, that her husband is dead in the next room? Mm-hmm.
Do you think kindness and empathy is derived from the word that we use or how we present and carry ourselves within that scene?
Well, I probably should say empathetic. Empathy is... Someone said to me, "Sandy, don't be sympathetic to your patients. Be empathetic to your patients." Makes sense to me. So I perhaps shouldn't use the word kindness, but certainly in deference to the fact that their husband is dead in the next room, to the fact that they are a senior to me in life experience and has been around longer than I have, and I think it deserves that a measure of respect in the way that you interact with them. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with the way Charlie wrote that. And the whole, what's opening up to paramedics now, and you know this, is the term palliative care paramedic, which is being fostered in a lot of countries. There's some great work in Canada. Cheryl Moore and Tyne Lunn in Alberta are breaking new ground in paramedics whom attend palliative patients. That's who they attend. The expected death, the near expected death, you know, the family, the friends all around, that sort of thing, and made, you know, medical assistance in dying. And what's the paramedic's role there? Because they are attending. They're attending to start the IV. They're attending to, you know, those sorts of things. That's happening now. And the question to the two of you is, what are we doing to both understand that, encode that, and pass that on to our students?
Well, at least we're starting a conversation.
It's a start. I don't think we have all the answers, but we can start. There's a great quote I heard years ago. It said that people don't remember what you say. They remember how you make them feel.
Mm. Oh, geez, that's a good way to wrap this one up, isn't it? This has been amazing. Like, this has been a really, really moving chat. And Sandy, I can't thank you enough for being a part of that.
Yeah, it's been good. I tell the story, like what I related in the middle part of this. I tell it a lot, but I think about it almost every day, and it really truly influences the way that I kind of try and deport myself. And I used to say, you know, kind of jokingly, we're all dying just at different speeds. So, but I don't, that's not as true as I used to be, and it was a bit of a euphemism for me anyway. We have an arc, and we just need to be as human as possible and interact with others as well as we can through that arc, however long the arc is.
Wow. Sandy, thank you for coming on the podcast
today. My pleasure.
Sonny, it's always fun.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
We'd love to hear the perspectives of our listeners on this topic. We don't have all the answers, and we'd love to hear from you. So please comment, reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram, or you can find our website, www.theshiftextension.org. But until next time, see you later.